Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The true story of Air Force men and women who struggled to prevent a mass murder and an aviation disaster, and the heroic response to both tragedies when the warnings go unheeded. Have you ever heard somebody say that a tragedy struck without warning? On June 20, 1994, a former airman sought vengeance with a rifle at the Fairchild Air Force Base Hospital. 4 days later, a rogue pilot crashed a B-52 outside of Fairchild's nuclear weapons storage area. Both tragedies had been predicted and repeatedly warned about. Warnings unheeded is a rare look inside the troubled mind of a would-be active shooter. It is an exclusive look at a talented pilot whose dangerous flying prompted air crews to refuse to fly with him. It is a look at the leadership culture that allowed both men to travel unchecked on the pathway toward destruction. This unique true crime book reads like a suspense novel, densely packed with details garnered from medical records, police reports, and first-hand accounts obtained from journal entries, letters, witness statements, and personal interviews. These empowering stories detail the heroic response to the tragedies, the events that lead up to them, the precursors of violence and disaster, and the traumatic aftermath. Written by Andy Brown, the man who ended the hospital killing spree, Brown's narrative focused mainly on others, including heroic life-saving actions of hospital patrons and staff, but he also describes the preparations he made which enabled him to win a pistol versus rifle gunfight, as well as his own experience with the effects of trauma. The book that we're featuring this evening is Warnings Unheeded, Twin Tragedies at Fairchild Air Force Base, with my special guest, author and former staff sergeant, Andy Brown. Welcome to the program, Andy Brown.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you very much for joining us with this incredible tale. Actually, two tales interwoven into one here, two disasters of epic proportions here. Let's get right to your background. You talked about sort of the Air Force and military being in your blood. Tell us about your life growing up, your mom and your dad, where you grew up, and what things shaped you and made you want to become a member of law enforcement?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Port Orchard, Washington, Washington State, and my family had a long military history. My father and grandfather were in the Navy. My brother joined the Army, and my sister was in the Air Force. My dad was also a firefighter after he got out of the Navy, so I was always interested in public service, and I was a volunteer firefighter for a short while, but I also had a fascination with firearms, so I eventually decided that I wanted to become a law enforcement officer. And right out of high school, really didn't have any career paths, and you couldn't become a police officer in a civilian life, so I joined the Air Force, and with the intent of going into the security police, the Air Force's military police career field. So at the age of 19, I joined the Air Force and went through basic training, and my first duty station was in Mountain Home, Idaho, which I kind of wanted to see the world, and the deserts of Idaho weren't exactly my cup of tea, so I put in for an overseas tour and went over to Greece, spent 3 years there, and then ended up at Fairchild Air Force Base, but I enjoyed the career. I enjoyed law enforcement. However, I didn't think that the training that we received was adequate enough, especially when it came to firearms. I took the job very seriously and knew that there might come a time where I would encounter a lethal force situation, and I wanted to be as prepared for that as I could be. And we only fired our duty weapons, the Beretta M9, twice a year. And so as soon as I could, I bought my own handgun. It was a clone of the Beretta, and practiced with it as often as I could. And just so that I could have the best marksmanship skills as possible outside of the training that the Air Force gave me. And I also wanted to work on my officer safety and my mindset, so I read a lot of books on tactics and such. And one of the things that I found most useful, especially in the incident that we're going to talk about, was mental rehearsal, where every night before I went to bed, I would envision a different lethal force encounter that I might experience someday, and I would practice what specific steps I would take as far as seeking cover and getting my sight alignment with my handgun and just visually practice those events, so that if I ever did encounter them, it would be like it wasn't the first time that I was experiencing it, and I would be able to just go on instinct and be able to automatically react to the situation in front of me. A lot of people made fun of me for that. They thought I was being paranoid, and with the different tactics that I would practice, they thought I was going overboard. But there were some who like me, took the job as seriously as we possibly could, just so that we would be ready, just in case we were called upon, and not only to save our own lives, but to save the lives of others. I made a commitment to myself that if I was ever in a situation and somebody's life was in danger, I didn't do all that I could to protect them, that I wouldn't be able to live with myself. So,
right. So tell us a little bit about Fairchild Air Force Base as well, and also the air show culture that existed there as well. And tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, Fairchild is located near Spokane, Washington. It was about 250 miles away from my hometown, so it was an area I was somewhat familiar with. But it had two aircraft stationed there at the time, two different types, the KC-135, which is a refueling airplane. It was like a modified airliner designed to carry a lot of fuel. And then the B-52 bomber, which was also the size of a small airliner, had maybe 185-foot wingspan, a very large, long-range bomber. But Fairchild, like most Air Force bases, had a long history of putting on air shows. Most of your air shows, they're mostly filled with single-engine jet fighters that are more maneuverable and can perform aerobatics, but Fairchild had a history of trying to use their heavy aircraft, the size of an airliner, in the air shows and performing aerobatics with those aircraft. They developed an air show stunt team with their heavy aircraft, and it resulted in a crash, a fatal crash, and that was in 1987. So they kind of stepped away from that and stopped that program. But then a few years after, they kind of forgot the lessons that they learned from that tragedy and started allowing the B-52 specifically to fly in some very dangerous aerobatic maneuvers that were crowd pleasers. It was very impressive, but it was also very dangerous if you knew anything about the handling capabilities of that airplane.
Tell us a little bit about your duties at the Fairchild Air Force Base, and then tell us just a little bit about the hospital, the medical center there, and the buildings that are around there that become important in this story.
Okay. I was a patrolman, a motorized patrolman for the most part, in a patrol car, just like you would see in a civilian law enforcement. We would patrol the base, doing traffic enforcement, responding to bar fights and loud noise complaints and domestic disturbances, that type of thing. the hospital, we had a full-size hospital on the base, but at this particular base, the hospital was located just outside the perimeter fence and was surrounded by two military housing areas on either side of it. It was a three-story building, and there was an annex building that used to be a dormitory for the medical personnel. It had been converted to office spaces, and one of the units in that annex building was the mental health facility. But it had the full capabilities of any other hospital, just like you'd see in the civilian world.
Right. Let's talk about Dean Melberg. You talk about Gary and Louise Melberg, and you've done extensive research to be able to tell about Dean's life with his parents. Very interesting the role his mother has in this story. And he was born in Lansing, Michigan. Tell us about Dean Melberg, like you do in your book.
Sure. Dean Melberg, he grew up in Lansing, Michigan. He was always kind of an outsider. He didn't have the social skills that most people did, and early on he showed some signs of mental health impairment and just didn't have just wasn't a normal kid. And in high school, probably throughout all of his school years, but especially in high school, kids were prone to picking on him because he didn't fit in. They would push him around in the hallways and verbally abuse him and trip him in the halls and knock his books out of his hand, that kind of a thing. One self-proclaimed jock said that he was treated like any other nerd who wouldn't defend himself. So I guess you could say he was bullied, but he also kind of brought that treatment upon himself. He just acted very strangely, and he was accused of openly masturbating in classrooms and staring at girls while he was doing it. There were people who tried to befriend him, and he just seemed to push them away through his behavior. One girl who took pity on him and tried to befriend him and be nice to him, he returned that favor by masturbating in class in front of her until she eventually just told him to leave her alone. And there were other kids who would be nice to him and befriend him, but he just always seemed to distance himself from his peers by mistreating his friends. He also had a mother who people say was very overbearing and very protective of him, which may have contributed to his lack of coping skills. Whenever something went wrong, she seemed to just step in and try to handle it for him and not give him any life experience. He had an interest in the military, and right after he graduated high school, he joined the Air Force. And it seemed like that was going to be his escape, where he could maybe get away from his mom's overbearingness and get a new start fresh and make a good life for himself, it seemed. But his behavior interfered with that as well. In basic training, he was pretty quickly identified as having mental health problems and was referred to the mental health facilities there at basic training. And they pretty quickly recommended he be discharged from the military. He wasn't military material. He had very poor social skills and paranoid or personality disorders. And the basic training instructor agreed that, yes, he shouldn't be in the military. He should be discharged. But it wasn't up to them. It wasn't up to the doctors either. They could only make a recommendation. And the commander of his basic training squadron overruled the doctors and told his TI, his training instructor, to get him back in training and let him graduate. Something similar happened at his tech school. He was going to school to be a lab technician, calibrating electronics and other equipment and tools for the Air Force. And at his tech school, He had problems with his roommates, and he threatened to set one of his roommates on fire while he slept. He told him he was going to douse him in lighter fluid and set him on fire. And that pretty quickly led to another referral to mental health, and I can only assume that they recommended his discharge from the military as well, but for some reason or other, none of the records exist on that trip to mental health from his tech school. But several of the instructors there recommended that he be kicked out of the Air Force, and they were overruled from the leadership rule. They said he's got good grades, and he's going to graduate soon enough, basically that it would be somebody else's problem. Let's just graduate him and push him down the line. And his very first duty station after tech school was Fairchild Air Force Base. And he wasn't a very good performer in his laboratory. He could perform well on tests, but he had a hard time applying any of the skills that he learned in the real world. So he was very difficult to train. And again, he had zero social skills. He didn't know how to talk to people. When he did speak, which wasn't very often, he would speak in a halting whisper. So he had trouble at work, but also with his roommates. He went through several roommates, and each one of them complained about him openly masturbating in front of them and their girlfriends. Just pretty, really difficult person to live with. So he was referred to mental health there at Fairchild. And again, they recommended he be discharged from the military. But his commander at Fairchild thought that the Air Force just spent a lot of money training him and that we need to get the money's worth out of him and give him a chance to adapt to military life. So the commanders overruled the mental health recommendation to discharge him and kept him in the military.
What was his aptitude, though? What was interesting was, and surprising to some people, what was his aptitude in the military towards, we'll say, marksmanship?
He was an expert marksman. He was allowed to train on the M16 rifle, and even though the mental health doctors at basic training said if he is ever kept in the military, he should be excluded from weapon handling and nuclear weapons facilities and such, but that word didn't get passed down the line, so he was allowed to train on the M16, and he was an expert shot with that. After he was recommended or referred to mental health, he developed a fixation on that and thought that just seeing the mental health doctors was going to be on his permanent record and ruin his military career. So he pretty much fixated on his roommate because the complaints from his roommate, which led to his referral to mental health, he began to stalk that roommate, and he became so fixated on the roommate's complaint that his work performance suffered even more. It was kind of a weird situation where if he'd have just let that go, he was going to be allowed to stay in the military, and because his commander was given a second chance. But by that time, he was so obsessed with the complaint that he pretty much let everything go as far as his work performance, and just obsessed over his roommate's complaint, to where that led to another mental health referral. And by that time, the doctors at Fairchild began to get the impression that he was a danger to himself or others, more so to him, to others, because of his fixation on the roommate, that they referred him to a mental health hospital in Texas, where he spent 90 days on the psychiatric ward of Wilford Hall Medical Center. While he was there, he received numerous diagnoses. The nurses there were afraid of him. He also exhibited his perverse behavior there, right in front of all the other patients and doctors. It didn't seem to matter. Nothing could stop him from masturbating openly in front of whoever happened to be in the area. But he was diagnosed with anxiety disorders and antisocial personality. A lot of the nurses thought that he was attending to internal stimuli or hearing voices. He would always just smile for no apparent reason and or laugh to himself. He was diagnosed with organic mental disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder, and most notably was a paranoid personality disorder and psychosis. Pretty much all the doctors there agreed that he should be discharged from the military, but about that time, his mother flew down to San Antonio and began spending a lot of time on the ward during visiting hours and began to interfere with his treatment. About the time that he had accepted the fact that, yes, he should get out of the Air Force, when she showed up, he began to fight his discharge again. And they enlisted the help of their congressman from Michigan. And when he made a congressional inquiries in the military really get people spun up. And there's a lot of speculation that just the inquiry made by the congressman made the people in the Air Force problem go away by allowing him to stay in the military. So he was discharged from that inpatient psychiatric ward and allowed to be stationed at another Air Force base in New Mexico.
You include in this book the journals from Dean Melberg. And so every time he has a mental health meeting with the doctor, and the doctor, as you write, reinforces that, again, they kept what's striking about this is that how many times he complains and tries to go over the head of someone else, again fixated on that the roommate threatened to break his alarm clock. And,
yes.
And the roommate, and he saw this as akin to the atrocities of the Holocaust. So these people were stunned that this reasonably intelligent guy exhibited this kind of disturbance, and they tried, it seems amazing how many people tried to talk him out of this, and then each time that they realized that this person had a serious mental illness that could not be abated, he refused meds, he refused any kind of therapy, so they wanted to discharge them. So it's amazing all the efforts and all the people. You talk about specifically the doctors that make reports that he is especially concerned with, and as you put in the book, he writes in his journal afterwards about his interpretation or his feelings about that meeting with those doctors. So can you tell us about Dr. Brigham and his meeting with Melberg?
Sure. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to get one person's side of it, like the doctors or his roommate, where they have a benign conversation with him, and then you go and read Melberg's journal entries about that same conversation and how threatening he perceived that benign conversation to be.
Right.
It's disturbing and pretty frightening. Dr. Brigham, he was a very gifted psychiatrist, and he was the loudest voice as far as determining that Melberg was a danger. He specifically put in the medical records that followed him to the psychiatric ward that they consider this patient dangerous, but not too many of the other doctors seemed to pick up on that as much as Dr. Brigham did. Dr. Brigham could see that he was a threat and did all he could to make the other doctors realize that so that they could get him discharged from the Air Force, but it didn't seem to happen.
What was his interaction with Dr. London, and what was his diagnosis?
They were both Dr. London and Dr. Brigham, they worked as a team. Dr. London was a psychologist, and Dr. Brigham was the psychiatrist there at Fairchild. And I think they were both pretty much in agreement, the two doctors, about Melberg being needing to be discharged from the military, they felt that he was maybe having an episode of brief reactive psychosis, but they couldn't really pursue that very thoroughly there at Fairchild because they didn't have an inpatient psychiatry section or a ward there.
Right.
Is there a specific instance you're referencing or asking about with London or Brigham?
No, but I just know that there is journal entries where he specifically, I mean, he has problems with many people, but he, especially the roommate Rayner, but then he singles out certain doctors, and obviously as we progress in the story, Dr. London and Dr. Brigham are two of those people. You also talk about this effort. You write about this effort for people to wash their hands of him at Fairchild. Tell us a little bit about those efforts to try to get him sent somewhere else, and as a result, what happens?
Yes. The commander and the leadership there at Melberg Squadron, where he worked at the precision measurement laboratory, by the time Dr. Brigham had sent him to the psychiatric ward in Texas, they had finally realized that he was beyond hope and was untrainable and that they should get him kicked out. And if he ever returned to Fairchild, they would have initiated some discharge paperwork. But instead of being returned to Fairchild from that psychiatric ward, he was given orders first to Mountain Home Air Force Base, which was my first duty assignment. But people got word that that they were sending him there, and somebody from Mountain Home happened to be visiting Fairchild and stopped by the laboratory and got the firsthand scoop of what they were going to be dealing with if they did get if Melberg was assigned to their station. So they pulled some strings and got his orders changed, and that's how he ended up at the base in New Mexico. And Dean Melberg, one of the things that he had a problem with Dr. Brigham and Dr. London, he because he realized that his orders got changed, he was under the impression that the two doctors were calling around and spreading rumors about him and ruining his career at the base that he was going to be stationed at. He
right.
felt like he was going to be showing up there and people were going to be aware that he was a problem, and he specifically blamed those two doctors for that. He wrote in his journal entry that basically these doctors are conspiring against him to destroy his military career, when it wasn't the doctors at all. It was an individual from Mountain Home's laboratory, happened to know somebody at Fairchild's lab and just got the inside scoop from them directly.
What was his mental state at that time in terms of a particular deterioration in terms of some of his character that would be noticeable by someone? Was there any noticeable mental deterioration at this time from previous?
Yeah, it seemed from the moment he joined the Air Force, his mental state was on a pretty progressive decline. And by the time he had spent the 30 or the 90 days in a psychiatric ward, it had slipped quite a bit. When he was discharged from the psychiatric ward, he spent some time there at Lackland Air Force Base while he was waiting to get his new orders. And he met a girl who he considered his girlfriend, and they did have a relationship, but he would make comments to her like somebody had done him wrong and he was going to pay them back, and that the police would have to be called and that the police would have to take him down and that he was going to go out with a bang. He basically was already laying out his plans to seek revenge, and it seemed like violence was the method that he was going to take. There was also an instance.
Go ahead.
Yeah, when he was stationed in the new base in New Mexico after the psychiatric ward. He was in Cannon Air Force Base, New Mexico, and pretty quickly ran into some trouble there that led to an encounter with the security police, the law enforcement. And he basically, as soon as he was brought into an interview room to be questioned about a benign incident, he shut down and was in basically a catatonic state, just staring at the wall. Prior to that, he seemed to be already practicing an act of workplace violence. It seemed like he was doing a dry run of walking through his laboratory with a large equipment case that was about the size and shape of a rifle, and he walked through the laboratory there holding that case at hip level like it was a rifle and acted out a workplace shooting. And there was an individual there who had already been warning his coworkers and leadership that he felt that Melberg was going to commit an act of workplace violence, and even went so far as to get permission to not allow him to practice any further with the M16 rifle. They canceled his weapons qualification because he felt he was such a threat.
Wow.
And shortly after that incident, he was referred to mental health, and they pretty quickly got him discharged from the Air Force.
Now, you talk about what happens with this discharge. You write about how they keep talking about a possible discharge and his plans. And what are his plans, if any?
What are his plans after the Air Force?
Yes.
He seemed to really not have any options open to him. He didn't seem to want to go back to his hometown and be with his mom or his parents. He stay in the Air Force, and he seemed like he was hanging on to that idea. He tried to enlist the help of his congressman again. He refused a plane ticket home. It was almost like he didn't think that he was going to be discharged. It seemed like he thought his career was going to be saved again. So he didn't really have any backup plans. So then when he was discharged, it was quite a shock to him. And he hung around there in the small town of Cannon, or Clovis, New Mexico, for a few days. And he'd saved up quite a chunk of money. He didn't spend his money on anything, so he just had a large savings account. And he withdrew all that cash and went on a bit of a spending spree. He bought new sets of clothing and rented a limousine and tried to go out to some nightclubs and such, but nobody would go with him. He was just by himself. He was such an odd person, though, that he didn't even take the price tags off of his new clothes. But eventually he ended up going back to the hospital at Lackland Air Force Base, where he was in the psychiatric ward. And he went and spoke to a psychologist that he seemed to have a good relationship with and was on a bit of a fact-finding mission. He was specifically asking whether or not anybody at Fairchild Air Force Base had requested any copies of his records and whether or not Wilford Hall Medical Center had released any of his medical records. And he was basically trying to see if the doctors at Fairchild were spreading any rumors about him. And it seemed from there, based on the answers that he got, he determined that doctors at Fairchild were still spreading rumors. It was unfounded, but it appears that that's where he determined that he needed to go back to Fairchild to seek revenge.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Andy, to stop for a second to talk about tonight's sponsor. Tonight's episode is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message a licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. All you need is a computer or the Talkspace mobile app. That means you can improve your mental health even if you've had trouble making time for it in the past. Get something off your chest whenever you need to. Talk about everyday challenges at work or at home. Just talk about your life. There are no extra commutes, no leaving the office. Talk space is there, wherever you are, whenever you are ready to talk. Therapy isn't just about venting your most private thoughts or exploring childhood memories. It's also about practical, everyday strategies for stress management and living a happier life. Having a therapist simply provides you a designated person for you to talk to, that person trained to listen to help you make positive changes. The Talkspace platform has over 2,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing life challenges we all face. To match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/murder and use the code MURDER to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. That's MURDER and Talkspace.com/murder. Now, Andy, we talked about all the circumstances and the confluence of events and his deteriorating mental health of Dean Melberg. It's interesting you write about how he spends a lot of this money on some dancers in a strip club, and he goes into a private room and tells this dancer his story of his life. And then, as we mentioned just before this break, that he's heading for vengeance to Fairchild Air Force Base. Tell us what happens next.
So after he left the hospital in San Antonio, where he was speaking to one of his psychologists, he flew to Alaska, and based on the research, Dr. London had orders to Alaska, and it's quite possible that Melberg knew about that and was going up there to confront him. Incredible. But he spent about a week there up in Alaska, staying in a billeting on Elmendorf Air Force Base. Billeting is like the hotel of the military. And then nobody really knows what he did up there, but we do know that right before he flew back to Spokane, Washington, the mental health clinic at Fairchild got a phone call from somebody asking if Dr. London was still stationed there. And when they answered in the affirmative, later that evening, Melberg caught a plane back to Spokane. And he was spotted on the base, and a lot of people were afraid of him and were alarmed that they did see him, that people were seeing him on the base, that he had returned there. But a lot of people also didn't believe the people who were reporting that they had seen him. They thought they must have been mistaken, because why would he come back to Fairchild Air Force Base? He's kicked out of the military. He has no business being back there. But there's some evidence that shows that he went out to the hospital and was in the mental health facility, almost like he was planning and preparing his attack. He also purchased a rifle while he was there in Spokane. He spent about a week in Spokane, and like you said, he was blowing large chunks of money at a strip club downtown, and he bought a Mac 90 rifle, which is a type of an AK-47, and he also purchased a 75-round drum magazine. Also, when Dr. Brigham had sent Melberg down to the psychiatric ward in Texas, he was so alarmed about his behavior and about what he believed he could do that he warned his wife, and he loaded an heirloom rifle and a shotgun and started keeping loaded guns around his house. He definitely knew that Melberg was a threat. He just apparently couldn't communicate that to the other doctors and the other leadership in the Air Force.
Wow.
So Melberg spent about a week there in Spokane, and on a Monday, he took a cab out to Fairchild Air Force Base, and Like I said, the hospital was located outside of the perimeter fence, so he didn't need to pass through any entry control to get to the hospital. Even if he did, though, he had been given a transition assistance ID card. He could have slipped right through the entry control, the gate. But as it turned out, he didn't need to. He just took a cab up to the hospital, and he had his rifle and the magazine in a large gym bag. And he got out of the cab and walked through the main hospital. Went through the lobby there and then exited and walked across the parking lot to the annex building. And it went into a bathroom inside the hospital annex, not too far from the mental health facility. And he went inside of a bathroom stall and assembled the rifle and magazine. He then emerged from the bathroom there and began walking down a hall with the loaded rifle and came upon Dr. London's office and pushed open the door and shot the doctor in the chest. He then immediately stepped back out into the hallway and walked two doors down to Dr. Brigham's office and again kicked his door open and shot that doctor in the chest. He then fired a shot down the hallway at people who had begun fleeing at this time and then exited the annex out into the parking lot and pretty much anybody he could see as he made his way over to the main hospital. He entered the hospital and into the lobby, which also doubled as the pharmacy waiting room, where there's quite a few men, women, and children waiting for prescriptions. And he just continued firing and pretty much fired nonstop, indiscriminately, as he was moving through the hospital. He moved down the hallways and past the ER and into a shot clinic. And there were some people who, nobody was allowed to carry firearms on the military base other than on-duty law enforcement officers. There were quite a few off-duty policemen and other hospital personnel who wished they had been carrying firearms, but even though they were unarmed, they did put up a fight. One individual in the shot clinic heard the gunfire coming down the hallway, and he tucked his daughter underneath a chair and stood on that chair near the door, and as the gunman pushed through the threshold of that door, this sergeant jumped down and grabbed the barrel of the rifle and began struggling for control of it. But by then, the gunman had fired so many rounds that the barrel was quite hot, and it burned that sergeant's hands as he struggled with him and pushed him out into the hallway and then shut the door. And as happens quite often when these active killers are confronted, they usually seek easier targets, and that's what Melbert did. As soon as he encountered some resistance, he turned and moved down the hallway and left the shot clinic pretty much unscathed. And pretty much everybody in the shot clinic there was able to escape out windows and seek safety and shelter in the housing area. Melbert moved down the hallway, retracing his steps, continued firing, and wounded several people. He went back out to the hospital lobby and shot several people a second time. It happened so quickly that some people fled and jumped out windows, and some people locked themselves in offices, but some people just dropped where they were, hoping to make themselves a less easy target. But some of the women who were shot in the lobby when he entered the first time were shot a second time as he passed through the lobby again. Yeah. He moved down a hallway towards family practice, continuing to fire. And by that time, several people had run through the halls alerting people what was going on. So the hospital was under an evacuation just from verbal warnings that had gone through the halls. As he approached the pediatric clinic, another individual put up a fight. Sergeant Root heard the gunfire and ran to a set of fire doors and pulled them closed and put his shoulder against them to hold them closed as the gunman was banging on the doors trying to gain entry to the pediatric clinic. Sergeant Root was yelling to his co-workers to evacuate, to take the parents and the children and get out of the pediatrics clinic. And so nobody was injured in that, in the pediatric clinic, thanks to Sergeant Root's actions. The gunman gave up trying to gain entry into the pediatrics clinic and moved down another hallway, pursuing people as they fled out into the parking lot. And once outside, once he was in the parking lot, he fired at people as they were hiding behind cars and scrambling into ditches. He then made his way out to the road that ran in front of the hospital, and he pretty much was firing at anything that drew his attention. And as a car drove by, he fired upon that vehicle and then started walking down the road back toward the hospital annex. I had been on swing shift. I was still a patrolman, but I was in a kind of a newly implemented program that we had, was bike patrol. So instead of being in a motorized patrol car, I was riding a bicycle that day. And my shift had started at 2 o'clock, and the incident, the shooting, started at about 3 o'clock. And I had already patrolled most of the housing areas on the base, the back gate, to patrol the housing areas that were on either side of the hospital. I had made it out to the back gate and was taking advantage of the air conditioning that was in the gate shack and visiting for a moment with the gate guard there when the call came over the radio. When the shooting began, there was quite a few people that made it to telephones. This was back in 1994, that cell phones were not a very prevalent thing, so most of the calls to the law enforcement desk and to 911 came from landline telephones. But within about a minute, there were several calls that had come into the law enforcement desk, and the desk sergeant immediately put out a call that there was an individual at the hospital with a shotgun. The people who had initially called in misidentified the weapon as a shotgun, but it still got the patrols headed that way. So when I heard that there was an individual firing off rounds at the hospital, I jumped on my bike and began riding toward the hospital. It was about 3/10 of a mile away on a straight two-lane road that led right to the hospital from the back gate. I remember seeing several vehicles driving toward me as I made my way toward the hospital. They were quite a few of them had rolled their windows down and were yelling at me, trying to get my attention and let me know what was happening at the hospital. But I remember there was a sense of calm that came over me right as I'd got the call. And also I began to experience some auditory exclusion, where my mind was so focused on the response and what I might do when I get there that the world kind of went quiet around me. I couldn't understand what these people were saying when they were driving past me, but I knew that there was trouble ahead, so I just kept riding. I didn't stop to try to figure out what they were saying. There was also a military dump truck that had stopped at the hospital and allowed several people to climb aboard, and as it rode past me, there were several people in the dump bed and hanging off the sides of the passenger door. And they were all screaming down at me and waving and yelling at me, trying to get my attention. But again, I couldn't understand what they were saying, so I just kept riding. The first building that you come to as you reach the hospital compound is the medical annex where the mental health clinic was located. And as I approached that building, as I neared it and it came into view, there was a large crowd of people that were moving toward me in the street. They were all wearing, some were wearing military uniforms, some were in hospital whites, and some were in civilian clothes. And at that time, there wasn't a description of the gunman. I didn't know who exactly I was looking for, so I scanned that crowd for a threat. And when I didn't see one, I rode through the crowd. And as I was driving through the crowd, I yelled out, "Where is he?" And several people pointed behind themselves, and they collectively yelled, "There's a man over there. He's got a gun, and he's shooting people." So I rode through the crowd, and about that time I began to hear gunfire, but I couldn't see exactly where it was coming from. The sound was reverberating off of the hospital buildings to my right and the military housing areas to my left, which was behind the perimeter fence. I rode further, and by that time I saw the gunman in the street. He was dressed in dark clothing and was holding a long gun at his hip, and he was firing to his left and to his right. So I immediately veered to my right and rode up onto a sidewalk and dumped my bike and drew my Beretta and went into a kneeling position and yelled at him to drop his weapon. I remember seeing people behind him in my line of fire. They were scrambling to try to get behind cars and behind cover and into the ditches. And I didn't feel very comfortable making a shot right at that time. I was worried that some of my rounds might endanger other lives. I know now that if you're responding to an active shooter, that there's no need to give him a verbal warning. But I didn't know 100% that he had already killed or shot so many people. And I also was, like I say, concerned about firing when there were people behind him. My command to drop the weapon was ignored, and he continued to fire to his left and right. And I yelled again, and he swung his rifle in my direction and began to fire. So I returned fire. I fired in succession as quickly as I could develop a sight picture and pull the trigger and reacquire that sight picture. I'd pull the trigger again. It was four rounds in controlled succession. The first three rounds didn't have any effect on him, and I was concerned that I was missing him. I didn't know how far away he was at the time, but I know that I had a hard time seeing him behind the front post sight of my pistol. His upper body was nearly obscured behind the steel front sight. But on the fourth round, he jumped up in the air and spun around and landed flat on his back. There was witnesses in the area that were hiding under cars, and some were in the hospital annex looking out the window that say that he fired repeatedly in my direction, and that he seemed to react to, if not my first round, one of my first three rounds, he seemed to react as if he was struck in the shoulder, but it didn't stop his behavior at all. But that fourth round hit him on the bridge of the nose and passed through his brain caused him to leap up into the air and land flat on his back. And he didn't move after that. As soon as he was down, I stood up and started moving towards cover. The last position of cover between me and the gunman was a pickup truck, a civilian pickup that was parked alongside the road. And I reached that pickup and covered him with my weapon as I waited for backup.
The police response here, you didn't call in before this, so you do the shooting, you call in, but there is reports that there's a second gunman. So the hospital is not in total communication for various reasons. What happens? You describe this chaotic situation. Why is it even more chaotic than it should be?
It was very chaotic because he moved through the hospital so quickly, and the eyewitnesses had they perceived differently due to the stress of it, that they were calling in different descriptions of him. Some people thought he was wearing a military uniform. Some people thought he was wearing shorts. And the calls continued to come in even after he had been, even after I stopped him. So it got confused. People thought that there was more than one gunman, and of shots being fired, he continued to come into the law enforcement desk several minutes after he had already been shot, and that the hospital was swarmed with law enforcement officers, who would have heard gunshots if they're in the area, but still some of the people on the scene were reporting that shots had been fired in the housing area and shots had been fired here, and that there was a sniper on the third floor of the annex, just because of so many different reports of and descriptions of the gunman that came in to the radio, to the law enforcement desk.
Right. When the toll is counted, you talk about Kristen McCarran, 6 years old, and Anita Lindner, of course, Dr. Brigham, Thomas Brigham, Dr. Alan London, and would-be born Taylor Sigmund, Michelle's unborn baby. And how many wounded? 22 wounded? Tell us a little bit about these deaths, as you write in a book, and also some of the wounded.
Yes, there was 22 people were wounded, and there were 4 lives lost at the hospital. And a 40-year-old wife of a retired military member was also shot and killed out on the street in front of the hospital. And an 8-year-old girl, Kristen McCarran, was shot in the chest as she was hiding in the cafeteria area of the hospital. One of the wounded, Michelle Sigmund, lost her unborn baby shortly after the incident. She recovered from her wounds, but the baby didn't make it. So there was a total of 5 lives lost and 22 seriously wounded. The death toll would have been quite a bit higher if it weren't for the actions of the men and women at the 92nd Medical Group. The only people who lost their lives suffered from what's been deemed as unsurvivable wounds. But due to the quick actions and medical care, the first aid that was rendered by several of the members of the hospital and civilians kept the death toll down. It would have been a lot higher had it not happened at the hospital. A lot of those people risked their lives, that they began rendering medical aid even as the gunman was still walking around firing.
You talk about the media response and their depiction of the event, questioning that they couldn't understand why this person, Dean Melberg, had gone on this rampage, contrary to all the information that you discovered and was available to them to a great degree as well. But despite that, that was a narrative that was done. You describe what happens right after you are briefed about this event and your feelings about that. Tell us about that briefing and your feelings after you've shot this perpetrator.
Sure. Yeah, it's frustrating when you see in the media they are so quick to try to report the story, and when they get on the TV screen, they sometimes run out of things to say, so they just say the first thing that comes to their mind, and quite often it's nobody saw this coming and nobody could have predicted that this choir boy in high school would one day become a killer. But when you read the book and you see so many warning signs after warning sign, and then you get to the first media report say that nobody could have predicted it, nobody could have seen it coming, it's very frustrating. But as far as my reaction to the incident. I suffered quite a bit of guilt. I know it's not something that's easily understood because I responded there, and most people say, oh, how many lives he saved. That it was quite a heroic response. But at the time, the only thing I could see is that so many people had been killed and wounded on my watch that, well, what could I have done to have gotten there sooner? And I second-guessed myself quite a bit, and it ate away at me for quite a while. I didn't have an opportunity to talk to anybody and to seek mental health counseling so that I could process the incident and work through it, and then eventually come to realize that I did do all that I could, and that there's no reason to be second-guessing myself. I did eventually come to that conclusion, but it took several years because whenever I would seek mental health counseling, I'd be relieved of duty and would no longer be able to carry my weapon and work patrol, which was a job that I loved, so discouraged me from seeking any mental health help until years later after I'd gotten out of the Air Force. But yeah, I never did experience any guilt from taking the gunman's life because it's something that I had practiced for and prepared for, and it's pretty easy to justify taking a man's life when he's in the midst of ruining so many other people's lives.
Yeah.
So thankfully I never experienced any guilt for that, and I did eventually finally come to terms with the fact that so many people were killed and wounded, but I did do everything that I could, and I do realize now that I did save lives.
And you get confirmation on top of that as well, in terms, in addition to the therapy that you did receive and the progress you did have in your mental health and dealing with the PTSD, you also got the Freedom of Information and realized that you couldn't have got to that hospital any faster. So any kind of guilt you would have had about your response time was gone. At least you had dealt with it in two different ways, really.
Yeah, there were several different steps that helped me come to terms with it. And it was a long process, but yeah, for quite a while I beat myself up because one of the physiological effects of responding or experiencing such a traumatic event like that is time distortion. And it felt like it took me forever to bike that 0.3 mile to get there to stop the killing. And I always, that's one of the reasons why I beat myself up, because it felt like I took so long to get there. And I made several requests to get a copy of the audio tape from the law enforcement radio so that I could kind of get a timeline of how much time elapsed from the radio call that dispatched me there to my call that shots were fired and that the gunman was down. And it took me, I think, probably 14 years to finally get a copy of that, which there's no excuse for that because it was readily available. It just people were dropping the ball and not allowing me access to it. But when I did finally get that audio tape, it was determined that it was less than 2 minutes from the first call for help to me radioing that the gunman was down. It's a 2 minute or less than 2 minute response time is pretty remarkable. So I began to forgive myself quite a bit for
We talk about, you talk and write about Fairchild Air Force Base, and we missed a whole part of this book because it is in a very detailed book, and you chronicle the story of the air shows and this rogue pilot named Bud Holland, who's respected but then is a daredevil and does things that are dangerous. And there are numerous reports very much paralleling what happens with Dean Melberg, in that many people of authority are saying, listen, this is dangerous, this guy should be reprimanded. Tell us what happens after this disaster at the hospital, and then the idea of air shows and Bud Holland. Tell us what happened.
Sure. I know we're under a bit of a time constraint, so I'll make it brief. there was a pilot at Fairchild that was very skilled and talented. He was a veteran B-52 pilot. He had more than 5,000 hours in the aircraft, and some of it was combat time in Vietnam. He was very talented, but he had also grown very increasingly reckless over the years. And coming upon his retirement, he was about to retire a few months after the shooting occurred at the hospital. And he had grown so reckless that a lot of airmen refused to fly with him. His crews didn't want to fly with him anymore because they were afraid that he was going to end up killing them. And he was selected to perform in the air shows at least 3 years in a row. And his stunts, he would fly that huge jet fighter, an 8-engine aircraft the size of an airliner. He would fly it like a single-engine fighter. He would fly low and slow and do turning around the control tower and bank the wings 90 degrees when it was only a couple hundred feet off the ground and where it had zero lift. He would also rocket the airplane down the flight line at a low altitude and then pull up and gain several thousand feet of altitude in just a few seconds as he pitched the aircraft up 80 degrees or more. But, that reckless flying that he did eventually caught up with him, and although several people were warning that he was going to kill somebody someday and that it would probably be at an air show where he might endanger the lives of all the spectators, they had warned about that, but the leadership failed to heed those warnings and allowed him to continue flying. And several people thought that the air show should be canceled after the hospital shooting, but it was allowed to continue. And 4 days after the shooting, during an air show practice flight, Bud Holland banked the aircraft around the control tower and banked the wings 90 degrees and plummeted the plane into the ground and killed all four of the airmen on board.
Incredible. And you talk about, too, that horrifically the wife of the aviator and his son or sons were there to witness this.
Yes. Yeah, one of the few commanders who took some steps to try to get Bud Holland grounded, when he was unsuccessful in that, he told his men that they would no longer fly with Bud Holland, that if anybody had to be his co-pilot, he would do it. So he was a true hero, and he ended up going down in that aircraft with Holland as he was trying to save the lives of his men. And his whole family witnessed that crash as they were watching the practice flight.
Yeah. There was talk of a lawsuit over negligence, or at first it would just, again, damages against the Air Force. Tell us about the attempt or the effort to do that and if that was successful or not.
For the shooting, there was a lawsuit brought. The individuals who are in the military were prohibited from bringing a lawsuit against the Air Force due to the Fares Doctrine, but the civilians who are in the hospital lodged a lawsuit with several
claimants.
They found several instances where the Air Force was liable, but the Air Force drugged the lawsuit out and kept putting it off. They were just waiting for it to go away or for the victims to pass away, because there were quite a few elderly people that were involved in the lawsuit. But so it took several years, but eventually they did come to a kind of like a plea deal where they awarded the victims several million dollars. But after the legal fees and having to split the settlement up between so many people, I'm sure it did little to make things right with the victims who are still living with life-altering injuries to this day.
were there any changes made as a result of these two disasters in terms of regulations or policy?
There were some changes that were made, but unfortunately, they were just very specific changes that might have prevented this very specific incident from occurring again. Didn't stop similar instances from occurring, and there's been one fairly recently. The shooting in the church in Texas was another airman who had been diagnosed or identified as a threat, and he was allowed to slip through the cracks and ended up committing another act of public mass murder. So there's still a lot that can be learned from this instance and others. But yeah, they did make some changes, like the hospital is now surrounded by a perimeter fence, but like I said, that wouldn't have stopped Melbourne from getting on the base anyway, because he had a temporary ID card.
You talk about the book being an opportunity for lessons to be learned, and as you just mentioned, maybe not too many lessons were learned. At least there wasn't any moves to make any radical changes, it seems. But for you, with your therapy and changes in your life, you got married, had children, I believe, and now you're working for the Department of Homeland Security. So you came through this difficult time, and you're doing something that you really enjoy. And so at least in changes that were necessary for you after this incredible traumatic event, those changes have been made in your life, all positive changes, haven't they?
Yes. Yep. I struggled for quite a while with mental health and anxiety and irritability and such, but I did persevere, and thanks a lot to my wife, who was very persistent and supportive, I've continued to seek counseling until I found something that worked for me, and I've pretty much made a full recovery and I'm able to enjoy life and function in society. You got to try to find the positive in all things. If my struggles with mental health led me to get out of the Air Force early, which was a very difficult decision because I loved my career field. But if I hadn't gotten out of the Air Force, I wouldn't have met my wife, and I wouldn't have the two kids that I do now. So I wouldn't have had the same life, and it may not have been as good of a life as I have now. So there are some good positives for the individuals in this if you look for it. But yeah, one lesson I would pass on is, if anybody is struggling with mental health, is to never give up seeking help. I've tried quite a few things that didn't help me or didn't help me very much, and just kept looking until finally I did find things that treatments and programs that did work for me, even though there was a time that I didn't think anything was going to help. Just got to keep looking and keep fighting for a greater mental health.
Part of that, I think, and maybe it's overused cliche of catharsis. You wrote this book 2016, I believe it came out, 2017.
Yep.
Was this book part of that, a part of catharsis for you? Was it good for you to write this book and get it out?
It was, definitely. Not only doing the research and answering all the unanswered questions that I had, but just confronting the incident and the trauma so deeply and repetitively. When you write a book, you write it several times over, but
sure,
each time I confronted an incident or just confronted the subject in general, the less effect it had on me as far as physical and psychological reaction. So it was a very cathartic process. And also having all the details and facts of the incidents in the book has helped others come to deal with it. I interviewed quite a few people who were involved in the incidents, and they've contacted me afterward and told me how helpful it was to know the whole story and to be able to read through it and re-experience it in a safe environment, to where it's kind of it's helpful to confront it and process it and work through it.
Absolutely. Yes, and congratulations on this, to Andy. It's a marvelous journey you take us on, to be able to see that the preparedness you had to be able to do this heroic, be able to involve in this heroic takedown of this perpetrator, that who knows how many more victims he would have got to if you hadn't had the presence of mind at that time, that day. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Warnings Unheeded, Twin Tragedies at Fairchild Air Force Base. For those that might want to take a look at and maybe contact you, do you have a Facebook page or website, or how can I find out more about this book?
Sure. You could search Warnings Unheeded on Facebook. There is a Facebook page for the book. There's also a website, Fairchild Hospital Shooting. And as far as the book, you could request it at your library or your bookstores. You can find it on Amazon. It's in print, audiobook, and ebook. For your Canadian listeners, it's available on Kobo also, Barnes & Noble. It's pretty much anywhere that books are sold. It's you can find it, Warnings Unheeded.
Thank you very much, Andy Brown. It's been fascinating. You have a great evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. You too.
Good night.